Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Are you looking to buy or sell a home in the Tampa Bay area without having to deal with pushy realtors? Then make sure you connect with West Florida Real Estate. West Florida Real Estate has helped over 300 homeowners and investors buy and sell their properties over the last 5 years. Their service is outstanding, just like back in the days when there was actually service in the service business, and you'll never have to deal with any kind of sales junk when you're working with them. For more information, email Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. That's A-N-N-E at westfloridarealestate.com. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. I have the honor and privilege of having not just a cool guy, but just an incredibly talented musician. J.R. Robinson's known for being the most recorded drummer in history, but he's actually a very talented musician, producer, engineer. And in fact, I'm going to let you in a little secret later. That is his studio that I just discovered this. Sounds better than Capitol Records, and we'll find out how that works later. But JR, thanks a bunch for coming on the show. Couple of quick announcements. First, I just want to thank our mutual friend James Harrah for connecting us. James, I appreciate it.
Love James, man. One of my favorite all-time guitar players.
Yeah, great. He's going nuts on
I see it.
Have you seen him on like he's doing these guitar things because he's like, you can see he's just about to explode with boredom, man.
You know, I should call him, man. We've been collaborating with all sorts of different cats, so he would be definitely one to do that with.
Yeah, that'd be good. Also make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe. Subscribe to the audio. If you're watching this on YouTube, click the button and the bell down there, and thank you. Let me tell you about JR. Grew up in a small town of 8,000 people, Creston, Iowa. Started playing piano originally at age 5 and drums at the ripe old age of 8. He turned pro when he started his first band, a little behind, at age 10. He went to Berkeley in 1978. He got his break and joined the band Rufus and Chaka Khan. He won his first Grammy with the hit record Ain't Nobody in 1983. He's literally the most recorded drummer in history. He's played on over, this is no joke, 500 million records sold. He's played on, this is really abbreviated. I would have no time to do an interview if I read the full list. But here's some of the hit records he's played on. Artists by Lady Gaga, The Corrs. Do you know... I think I looked. You played with Anto Drennan.
I don't know if that was directly or not.
Because I looked at the album.
I did a couple of Coors records.
Yeah, and I looked. He was on those sessions too. Great, great player. Lovely guy too. Ikichi Ozawa, Quincy Jones, Michael Jackson, Rufus, of course, Chaka Khan, Stanley Clark. He was on my favorite fucking record, Rocks, Pebbles, and Sand. I listened to that.
Is that the one where Stanley brought Lewis in also?
I don't think so. I think you were, it's the record. It was like 80 or 81.
It was 80, I think.
Yeah. Cause I remember that record. Cause the quote in my high school yearbook was from that song, Life is Just a Game. It was such a great track, man. Great record.
Thanks.
Brothers Johnson, George Benson, Bill Champlin, who was on this show. That guy's a warrior. Herbie Hancock, Herb Alpert, George Duke, the Pointer Sisters, Glenn Frey, Tavares, Kenny G, Donna Summer, Lionel Richie, Neil Diamond, Frank Sinatra, The Temptations, The Isley Brothers, John Fogerty, Dionne Warwick, Eric Clapton, Bob Seger, Michael McDonald, Larry Carlton, David Sanborn, Steve Winwood, Peter Cetera, Randy Newman, Frampton, Joan Baez, Robbie Robertson, Paul Jackson Jr., who we had on here a while back, Steve Warner, who we had on here a while back, Christopher Cross, Bill Medley, and literally hundreds of artists. John's been the drummer for Quincy Jones since 1979 and the drummer for Barbra Streisand from 93 through 2014. Was John Shanks produced those records or some of them?
No. I mean, you know, it depended on the orchestral stuff was like, you know, the executive producers and then Bill Ross, the conductor, would do it.
Okay. Because I had John on here. I know he's done work.
I know John, though. Yeah.
And he's also been the drummer for the Oscars multiple times. He's played on motion pictures, soundtracks, including My Cousin Vinny, That Thing You Do, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, Hairspray, Anchorman, and like one of my favorite movies of all times, Austin Powers, Goldmember. When you have two sons, man, you have to like, it's like a staple.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah, man, you got to watch all the Austin Powers movies. Dodgeball, Hangover, a great series, Hangover 1, 2, and 3, Batman vs. Superman, The Lion King, and loads of others. He's got two or three solo CDs.
Two
solo CDs and an educational DVD called Time Machine, which actually won DVD of the Year by Modern Drummer Magazine. So if you're a drummer looking to, you know, improve your chops, definitely check that out. Again, it's called Time Machine. And John has been touring with legendary producer and artist David Foster. John, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I'm exhausted just from reading this.
Greg, it's my honor, man. And when, you know, James goes, man, this guy Craig, you know, he wants to get a hold of you and stuff. And I go... But he's a guitar player. He goes, that's right.
Well, like, you know, 15% of our guests are not guitars.
Hey, listen, man, I could like pan over here and you could see my rack of guitars over here. So I'll tell you, that instrumental night when the Beatles came on Ed Sullivan, you know, I'm drumming, man. I'm a little kid and I'm still drumming, but I see my older sister like Google-eyed when the Beatles came on Ed Sullivan. And I go, but you know, brother sister thing, and I'm thinking I'm gonna play guitar, because after I saw those guys playing guitar, nobody gave a shit about Ringo.
Yeah,
you know, it was the three guys up front, and I go, and I'm gonna learn. So I learned guitar right after that show.
Really? But drums was just always your passion.
Yeah, drums came by a bolt of God.
Yeah,
I got hit hard at an early age.
I read something just yesterday, in fact, it said that you know you're talented when something comes to you easier or more naturally than other people, than it comes to others.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I haven't ever heard it put that way, but that makes sense.
It's pretty accurate. Yeah, I thought so. All right. Yeah. What? Obviously, you were super passionate about music in general at a young age. Where did that come from, or where do you think it came from?
Well, I think initially I had it coming out of the womb, but... You know, it takes parenting, even to this day, if there's 25-year-old parents that have a little baby and you influence that baby with all sorts of musicality, no matter what it is, I don't care what it is, that baby's going to become musical.
Yeah.
And it's the times where the parents stop influencing the children when the child stops. And the exceptional ones will power through it. My dad was a doctor, but he also was a great violinist and a great piano player and arranged for chorus and was just fantastic and sang in a barbershop quartet.
Oh, that's
cool. And then my mother was, she taught me about the word swing and used to play me big band records when I was a little boy. And so, you know, one of my statements has always been, 50% of learning is listening.
Yeah, man, ain't that the truth?
So that's kind of how I got, you know, my parents, I didn't have a drum set until I just about turned 8, you know, at the end of 7. And I remember because my parents were getting divorced, excuse me, and that divorce definitely shook me up, but it shook my sister up more because she was older. So I didn't get it, but I was always just whining about, I want a drum set. So I was over at my dad's house, which is like 4 blocks away, and they specifically kept me over there so they could set up this old WFL set, which I still have.
Wow.
And, yeah. However, the snare drum got stolen at Berkeley in 73, so I have a clone of that, and I still have a lot of eyes out there looking, so...
Yeah, if you stole JR's, on the off chance, if you've got his original, no questions asked, man, just contact me or contact him.
Black? black early 40s Duco.
There you go. Please return it.
Anyway, so I remember getting out of the car and coming back home and running up to the window because I knew some shit was up. And there was a little drum set sitting in there. And so I bolted in and sat down on it and held the sticks wrong, like a claw, like wrong. But the first groove I played was a swing groove, you know, thanks to my mother.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of the beginning of the, you know, that it was kind of like when your passion gets acknowledged.
Yeah. True statement. The number one thing successful musicians have in common from the close to 700 guests I've had on this show is support from parents. Number one thing, like 99%+.
Yeah. And just let me plug young kids that are going to listen to this.
Yeah, please.
And if they're having a baby and, you know, they're thinking about, you know, I've got neighbors around me, one neighbor, this family over here, all baseball. No piano, no violin, no drums, you know. So I can understand, you know, one passion level. But, you know, to be great parents, you need to, you know, I was an all-star basketball player.
Oh, which wow.
You knew. So we could talk about that.
I didn't. This guy is immeasurable in talents, man.
Of course, I can't fucking walk now. Or, you know, Lenny DeMuzio used to say he had a handicap. He'd drag that third leg along.
Oh, my God. Breaks, man. Your first big break, I guess, was when you became a member of Rufus and Chaka Khan.
Yeah. I mean, I had a really glorious upbringing, you know, with grade school, junior high, and high school, jazz camps, music camps, blah blah, going to Berkeley. But you know, when they people talk about a break, it's like I remember, you know, the drummer Joe Hunt.
I do not.
He's from Philadelphia. He was one of the great Berkeley teachers when Alan Dawson was teaching, and Joe. I think Joe's still in the Boston area. Joe asked me to sub for him when I was 18 and play with Chick Corea's cousin. Her name was Lynn Stewart, I think her name was. And she was a pianist, singer, jazz singer. So I went and played, and all of a sudden, I remember, like, you know, I've been in clubs and famous people come in, and then you get all uptight. You start to overplay. And Chick Corea walked in. I go, fuck.
Holy Chick shit. Corea.
And I always was, you know, we idolized Chick Corea because of, you know, it was Return to Forever and it was the beginning of that massive band. And I went up to him and I go, one day I'm going to play with you. And he looks at me and he goes, one day you will.
Oh, wow.
I only played with him once. But the point was, I remember getting uptight about when he walked in. And when I was out with my band touring in Ohio called Shelter, is when Rufus and Chaka Khan all walked into the club. And I remembered what I remembered from that earlier night was don't get uptight. Don't get nervous. Just be yourself. And sure enough, man, right at the end of the set, the whole band was sitting up in the front and they're like, and then we were stopping and they talked to the leader guy. They go, can we sit in with your drummer? And I go, yes. So the next set was the new Rufus and then Shocker kind of, you know, gets up there and it was brand new Rufus.
Yeah.
And so it was about me learning not to overplay. Don't be somebody else, be yourself, you know, that sort of thing.
Did you have to, like, when you're in situations like that, cause that, as you know, doesn't happen. I mean, it always happens the rest of your life. It may not be, well, you know, you're concerned about someone watching you play, but something that has a potential to trigger you. Do you tend to be able to do that all the time? Like talk to yourself and say, hey man, I mean, like, that's what I do. I literally talk with myself if I'm stressed or uptight and I'll like try to look at me as if I'm not me. Like I'm somebody else. Is that something that you do or do you tend to get wound up?
I don't get wound up. You know, I think I've been able to, you know, secure people skills and even if you get thrust into a session where there's somebody in that session that maybe is not up to your caliber,
yeah,
or there's somebody in the session that doesn't get the band concept, you know, you learn how to deal with certain issues.
Right.
Or you know, now we have a box that we can just mute these guys.
Technology's come to the rescue. Oh, wow, that's pretty funny, man. Does that, wow, that probably happens a lot, a guy your caliber, where you have somebody where probably less that they're not of good caliber, but they're not just considerate of the team.
It could be. I mean, it could be, but I've been really blessed, you know, playing with like guys like James Harrah or Dean Parks, you know, or, you know, Lukather in the old days, you know, Landau, Thompson, Jackson. I did a lot of work with Larry Carlton, and, you know, I learned a whole bunch from him. But, you know, to be able to be in, into a situation. But you know, George Benson was really an exceptional you know, to me, one of the greatest times I've ever, you know, learned. I mean, George Benson always thought of himself, as the greatest guitar player in the world. Man, I'm the greatest guitar player in the world, man. But in reality, he's just a cat that wants to play with some other guys.
Right.
And he just, and he loves it. And he likes people around him that can help showcase his talents.
Yeah.
You know, I really enjoyed playing with George.
That's awesome, man. All right. So once, okay, at a certain point in time, Rufus sort of broke up.
Yeah.
Right. And I know you came back from the, for the reunion much later, but once that gig was over, what did you do?
Yeah. And that was an interesting scenario. Initially the day I joined Rufus, well, I left and drove from Boston via Iowa to California, which I had never done before. It was one hell of a trek.
Yeah.
And joined the band. And then we finished up that 78 world tour. And there were three gigs. And the first gig was in Hawaii. And I go, wow, this is great. I'd never flown first class. We're going to Hawaii, blah, blah, blah. You know, but the whole band was, you know, at the end of a year's tour, they were strung out. And so, you know, I hung with Shaka right when I got there, and Shaka's looking at me and she's going, man, I'm leaving the band. I go, oh my God, I just got in the band. She goes, well, why don't you come with me? And you can get anything you want. I'll give you a record deal. I go, yeah, you know, cause when you're 23 years old, you'll believe anything.
Sure.
And I basically looked at how gorgeous she was. And I go, no, because the four guys wanted me in the band. So I opted to stay with the guys and struggle through when she left us and had I Feel For You and those Machine hits, knowing that we were going to eventually get back together again. So that was an interesting thing. But right after, let's see, well, how was this? Quincy Jones was asked to produce a Rufus and Chaka Khan record because she hadn't formally left, and it was called Master Jam, and it was on MCA, but it was Quincy Jones was really good producer with bands, but he didn't get a lot of bands. He had the Brothers Johnson and us, and we were a lot more difficult for him than the Brothers Johnson. There were only two of them.
Yeah.
And we were going through, you know, all sorts of shit. Chaka was going through her shit, and I was fresh and young and bringing this energy. And what happened was we had a couple of good hits on that record, and that record went platinum. And then right at the end of that record, I got asked with Ed Eckstein and Quincy, do you want to just stay on and we'll start recording Michael? I go, fuck yeah. I go, so, I mean, in reality, my drums never even moved. They stayed at a studio called Alan Zentz. And we had the same damn team with Bruce Swedeen and the engineer. And I literally went from Rufus to Michael without a breath. And then we went into 10 more records right in a row. So Quincy Jones, if people look at my DVD, there's a point where he gets interviewed and he goes, you know, I stole you from Rufus. He goes, it's the best thing I ever did or something like that. And I go, well, mission accomplished. That was
man. Wow. So let me ask you a couple of questions about that. You said it was Zentz. Was that the Zentz in John Fogerty's
No, that's okay. Zant.
Zant. Okay. Okay.
That was Saul Zant.
Saul Zant. Right. And
this was called Alan Zant's.
Okay.
And it turned into a studio called Image. It was right around the corner from the newer record plant.
Okay.
Off of Sycamore in Hollywood.
Why do you think, besides technical chops, okay, what has in what do you think have been some of the things that account for your success beyond your ability to play drums? Because you've had like an unprecedented run here, man. I mean, literally no one's done something like that.
Well, we're not done either. Hopefully, yeah. Knock on wood. But, yeah. You know, hence the Lady Gaga perfectly quantized song. But, you know, again, I go back to parenting, good parenting. I go back to discipline, not being a drug addict, you know, during those heydays, getting to the studio early, getting to know your engineer, finding out what kind of mics he likes and how he likes to mic the drums, and get, having a give and take with the engineer about miking techniques, when you hear a song, immediately memorize it. And then, you know, when you look at it, and then there's a chart, listen to what the songwriter had intended. Maybe write it down, and then write maybe what you might do all during the same time. So the second time you hear the song, you already know the song. And I think a lot of people don't understand about you know, this memory thing and try to, you know, oh, shit, I can't even remember what the B section was. Now, granted, cats are playing chords and there's a little bit more information sometimes. But in reality, I'm still, you know, running four limbs and trying to create a band finished product from the get-go. You know, for example, an off the wall. We used to use a Yuri 7-frame click, like a film click.
Okay.
And I would be in charge of that because of my time. I had, you know, I'm very blessed. I have good time. So I would like listen to Michael and these songs that would come out from Rod Temperton. And I go, I don't know. It feels a little slow. I think we should bump it up to here. Cause Quincy wanted everything cut. Bruce wanted everything cut with a click so he could come back and edit later. And we were all analog in those days.
Okay.
No digital hadn't even come out yet. And so I would program all the clicks and then make sure everything felt right. And then we would go in and cut as a band. And we would find out at that point if indeed it's working. If it's not working, then what do we do to fix it?
Okay. So a couple of things that you mentioned I'd like to talk about because I think they're really important. This is the second time you mentioned the importance of listening. You said 50% of learning is listening earlier. And then you said, listen to the song. So I'm hearing in that some of this is like efficiency, like pay attention and get the shit done right the first or second time is part of the magic there, your ability to put a final product together quick.
Right.
Yeah. And
right.
And when you said discipline, what does that mean for you?
Well, I think drummers, you know, I guess we all have discipline. I mean, when I went to Berkeley, I loved the guitar players, but there seemed to be a whole bunch of them. And I don't know if they were all as disciplined as the drummers were. The drummers are disciplined because of growing up techniques with rudimental training and time training and things like that. I think drummers are I mean, not to take anything like, you know, away from a Chuck Finley, a lead trumpet player, who or Jerry Hay, or equally as disciplined, and or any other musician. But I guess I'm prejudiced.
Well, yeah, no, but just I don't even care about. Just talk about you. Like, how, for you, what does discipline mean? Like, because I read a lot, and I have read a lot over the years, and the number they've done studies of there's a book by a guy named Tom Collins. I can't think of the name of it now, but he went and did a study of like major companies around the world, what made them successful. And the number one thing was discipline.
Oh.
Yeah, for companies. So, and it's the same thing with people. I think it's the same thing with people. But for you, what kind of discipline are you like when you think discipline for yourself? What does that mean for you?
Well, let's look at it today's times. Yeah. I'm older now. We're all confined into our homes like, you know, little mice. And am I practicing as much? No. Should I be? Yes. However, I know when a moment goes by or something, I'm doing something to stimulate that brain. And as far as actually picking up a pair of sticks and either playing on a drum set, I do that every day. I'll play the drum set every day, or I will be on a pad, but most of the time it'll be on one of, you know, a couple of drum sets are rolling around the house. You know, and I don't have these massive drum sets. They're just drum sets for drumming.
Yeah.
For groove and for swing and stuff. And so if I feel that I'm not, if I'm slacking in some way, something will remind me and my eyes will go over to that practice pad. I go, yeah, shit. Yeah, you're right. You know, I gotta work the hands out, you know, and it's just, it's very similar to a basketball when you put the basketball in your hands and you feel it, you feel the ball. It's the same thing with feeling the drumsticks. And yeah. So somehow something knocks on my head and says, hey, you know, don't slack. No slacking.
Yeah, that's you know, like no different hearing you than you listen to, you know, when Michael Jordan was playing. You know, he's the first guy in and the last guy out.
That's right.
You know, he's there taking fouls. The great, and that's how you stay great, man. Thank you, because I think that is really important and is like some basic fundamentals like that that are not fun per se. But that's, you know, an important part of what, why you've done this, man, why you had this track record. I'm going to mention some artists. Talk about how you got the gig with them, JR, and like if there's any cool or interesting stories about working with them. Start with Eric Clapton.
Okay, the first time, I just expanded the screen. First time.
That's scary. Yeah. Sorry.
No, that's all good. The first time, I'm just eyeing that Les Paul there. Oh. No, I'll take the 335.
No, that's my baby.
Anyway, I'm so sorry. Oh, you got an L? Is that an L7?
No, it's an Ibanez, man.
Oh, and that's like a George.
Yeah, it's like a 175. It's a really nice sounding guitar, man. Anyway,
Eric Clapton. We had gone. Rufus and Shaka had re-signed with Warner Brothers. Mm. And I think because of that information, I met a lot of really cool people. And I got a lot of really great gigs after that. Lenny Warnker was president of Warner Brothers. I got to meet Lenny, knew his son Joey when he was a little punk.
That's funny.
And gave him one lesson. And but they were always really, really, all the guy, Joe Smith and all these Warner Brothers, Russ Titelman and all these great Warner Brothers producers, Michael O'Mardian, we were all kind of connected. And, I got a call and I can't remember who called me, saying you want to, you know, do an Eric Clapton record and we're going to do it over at, old Warner Brothers studios, which was called, Amigo. And it's like, you know, sometimes the brain forgets for a second. So,
oh, dude, you got a lot of information there. Give yourself a pass, man.
I know. And I do want to do a book one day, by the way. And that's just, you know, now we need funding. So that's something off the record you can help me with. So we'll figure it out. But so I get a call and I go down and Nathan East is there and Greg Fillinganes is there. And Eric walks in with a fucking pig nose. That, remember those little
pig those nose? Little, I have one in my closet. Yeah, those are cool as hell.
He walks here with a pig nose and I'm like,
ha. literally had a pig nose as the volume.
Yeah. And I go, you're gonna play that? He goes, yes, I'm going to play that. And you know, he didn't know, but you know, I had a Cream band in, you know, 66 and 67 in Iowa, and we'd win these talent shows and it was a great band. We did everything and I sang Crossroads and it was fun. And so that was the first session I did. And I think it was on the record Behind the Sun. And
he played his pig nose? Did he legit?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
He played the pig nose. And it sounded unbelievable.
Wow.
I got, you know, I mean, he could, I always have this joke that I could probably put a couple of boxes together and sound great. You know, he could probably, you know, take a Heathkit signal and make it sound unbelievable.
You know? Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure that's pretty – I mean, look, it's the magic is inside of you, not in your equipment, man.
Yeah, so that came out. I mean, and I didn't know a lot about his personality. And I think it was 82, something like that, or 83. And, you know, I didn't know he was – you know, kind of going through a shit.
Yeah, he had, he wasn't sober though, I don't think, was he?
Yeah. No, he wasn't. He didn't have a shit together.
Yeah.
So that was the first time I worked with him.
Very cool. What second time? It was another time?
So, yeah, I worked with him three or four times. The second time was Rob Reiner did a film called The Story of Us with, Blonde, who played Catwoman.
Julie Newmar?
No, but I later.
I know who you're talking about. I can't think of it. Julie Newmar. Talking. That's like way back there.
she was in that movie with Mel Gibson. I can't remember who the man was, but Eric scored the film.
Was that like a soppy love story? Like a sad? Yeah, I remember seeing that.
It's sad.
Yeah,
and he scored it, and we were at some legit studio. It was a legit session, and you know we're all in there. And again, it's the same rhythm section. It's Greg, Philip Gaines, Nathan East, myself, and Eric comes in, and so I bring all the music in, and hand it out to everybody. You know, here's your keyboard part, here's your bass part, there's my drum chart, and here's a lead sheet for Eric. And Eric looks at me and he goes, "Yeah, I can't read. I don't need that."
Oh wow.
I go, "Oh, okay, cool. I'll take that." And, you know, I'm just doing what I thought I should do.
Yeah. It was pretty responsible of you, actually.
And then the most memorable one was Change the World.
Oh, yeah.
That Babyface produced. And it was me, Babyface, and Dean laid that track down initially.
Right.
And then all the other cats filtered in and overdubbed on that. So...
the talent that you've been around is pretty like impressive, man.
I've been very blessed. I mean, you know, it's like if you plug your A game into a B team, you're going to play like them.
Yeah.
Generally.
Yeah. You know, so. That's great. Stanley, how'd you get connected with him and any cool stories about working with him?
There's stories that probably shouldn't be on the radio. Stanley, well, again, one of my just favorite people in the world, one of the greatest all-time musicians. I'll tell a story. First of all, I got a call. I'm not sure if he called me directly. I saw him somewhere. I think I met him in early 1980 or late 79 because the Rufus thing was very successful. And he goes, "Man, I'd love to have you play drums on my records." I go, "Cool."
Holy shit.
So I got a call. You know, he didn't know. I saw him at, with Return to Forever in 74. And like going, "This is the greatest shit." By the way, Al DiMeola was in my class at Berkeley for 2 weeks.
And what happened? Just two
weeks. And this old woman, we're at an air trading class, and there's a bunch of us. And this old woman comes in, and she goes, "Is there Albert DiMeola in the class? Raise your hand, Albert." And all of a sudden you see him, he goes, "You're excused. You just got the Chick Corea gig." And he walked out and goes like that to us.
Oh, my God. That is so funny.
That's my Al DiMeola story.
That's great, but, man. You're excused. But, you got the Chick Corea gig.
Yeah, he got the Chick Corea. He didn't even fucking go to Berkeley. Come on. He says he went to Berkeley. Anyway.
That's great.
So Stanley calls me, and I think you were right. Their first record is Rocks, Pebbles, and Sand?
Yeah, I think so.
And I did a couple of things on there. One, he always had a fascination for another bass player. So he could literally be his frustrated guitar player self. And there was one track on there with Lewis Johnson, because Lewis and I were a team all the time.
Okay.
Playing all these records together. And it was something funk. Somebody have to look it up, but I don't remember the name of it.
The name of the track, you mean?
Had so much bottom on it,
yeah.
And Stanley's emulating Lewis's shit, and you know Lewis. Well, there's only one Lewis Johnson, God bless his soul, and But that track was really funky. And then after that, I get introduced to George Duke.
Oh, wow. From Stanley.
And right then I joined Clark Duke at the same.
Oh, my God.
With Rufus. And I was thinking, oh, man, I would rather be here than do this Rufus thing because Shaka is really iffy, you know. If Shaka's on point, that's the best band to be in.
Yeah.
You know, because it's a rock, jazz, soul band with mixed race. And it was just, it had the whole Sly Family Stone vibe, you know. And
it was right for the times.
It was right for the times. Yeah. And it still may be right one more day, but we'll see. But so I started doing stuff with Stan and George. We did two records, but we did SNL on so it was 1980. And I think that was year six. So there's a video of us on Saturday Night Live, and it's the one, and it's posted on my Facebook or website. I don't know where. You can find it. And we played a song. Now, mind you, we were all young and just very, very, what's the word, vehement or vile almost. And we wrote a song called Wild Dog, which Stanley has always done. And it's this was the one Saturday Night episode where there were two musical artists. One was Cheap Trick and the other was us.
That's weird.
It was weird because Karen Black was the host. And Karen Black was friends with Stanley.
Actress. Yeah, right. I remember her.
Well, of course, she had to pass, but she was very friendly with Stanley. So she goes, I've got to have Stanley in his band. So I get a call from Corinne Duke going, we're going to New York. So the three of us fly to New York, and Karen picks us up in a damn limo, and we go on, and Lorne Michaels is going, oh, shit, man, what am I going to do? We got two fucking musical acts. What do we do? You know, and it's 10 till, you know, how you film SNL. And we came out and just, bam, gun, 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 gun. You'll have to watch it.
I'm going to watch it. So if I look up SNL, Stanley Clark, George Duke?
Maybe season six, Karen Black.
Okay.
And or you have to look through either my Facebook or my website. It's awesome. An obscure, but you'll find it. And it was like after we had played that, it was like that Maxell commercial with that dude where it was all slick back hair.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was like we gassed everybody.
That's so cool, man.
Those are good days.
It's interesting how he, because like, do you know, I'm sure you know Reggie Hamilton.
Extremely well.
Yeah, great guy, man. I had him here. We had a blast.
And really talented.
Oh, man, he was Stanley's bass player for quite some time.
That's right. And, yeah. And also, Johnson. I'll think of it a second.
Yeah, yeah. It was another guy. Yeah, but it's interesting because I said, wait a minute.
Alfonso
Johnson. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I said to Reggie, I said, how is it that you were playing bass with Stanley? And he said that. He goes, he played piccolo bass, or he was like a guitar player in the band when Reggie was holding down the bottom. Yeah, which is great for guys like that.
Yeah, I think Steubenhaus also was one of the bass players.
Interesting. Very cool. So how long you were with Clark Duke for how long?
Just a couple of years, but it wasn't consistent. And all during that time, I was recording.
Okay.
And that's where a lot of these numbers came from.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I met, you know, Lionel, and I had known Lionel from the Rufus days. And, you know, I went in 1981 and recorded You Are with him. And I knew right out of the gates that was a number one record.
Wow.
And then, you know, got into the more stuff with them. And then I started working for the Pointer Sisters. And, you know, the coolest one, I think, after Michael Jackson's Off the Wall, which is backing up a year, was Diana Ross. And we did a song called that James Anthony Carmichael produced. And Abe Sr. was playing bass and myself. It was called Missing You. It was a tribute to Marvin Gaye. And that was a number one record. And it's ironic because my first wife at the time was from Detroit and Diana was from Detroit. And the next day I had a 3-foot bouquet of flowers in my door. And it said, JR, just thank you for contributing this. I love you, Diana. And of course, I don't know if we have to edit this out, but my first wife is going, what are you fucking her, man?
I don't care. We can keep it. It's quite funny, actually. You should have said something like, no, if I was fucking her, I would have gotten like a car or something. that's quite funny, man. Wow. But you, man,
she's into you, really. No, I'm kidding.
How kind is that of her?
I'll never forget it.
Yeah, I always look at things like that say a lot more about someone's character than, you know, than other things, because that's like a really kind, humane, just she doesn't have to do that. No, you know,
she was very, very sweet. Yeah. And still is.
That's awesome, man. Herbie Hancock.
Ooh. Oh, let me pray. By the way, happy birthday. A little bit later.
That's right. I saw that.
Man, you know, I was thinking, I was looking, he goes, he's 80?
I know.
He's 80? I go, shit, man. I remember when he wasn't 80. So, I mean, that's like getting to the Quincy Jones age. And then I didn't realize they're only 6 years apart.
Quincy's 86?
86, yeah. But Herbie, you know, I think that all of us drummers were in love with Herbie because of the Miles Davis situation.
Okay.
And, you know, when he was a young kid and, you know, we kind of like grew into him and still, in my opinion, to this day, he is the greatest living musician.
Herbie Hancock.
There's no question. And, let's see, the first time, I mean, dude, I used to run around. I'd keep a vinyl stereo in my 67 Dodge Monaco 500. So when I was like, you know, at another city and I'd plug it in my hotel and I'd put on Headhunters.
Wow.
And I'd be obsessed with that. So, but I first met Herbie. Golly. I met Herbie the first time on a Quincy Jones session. Where he played on, it was on The Dude, and he played on two tunes on that record. One was I Know Corita, and he's really playing a lot of shit, almost too much. It's almost too much emotion, and I noticed it, but, I'm just a kid. Man, yeah. I'm not going to say anything. And then he played on another song, and, you know, if he didn't.
That was probably a good career move not to say anything.
Yeah, I probably was. Yeah, but I remember Bruce Swedeen, you know, the great engineer and Quincy's right arm, coming out to all of us session players and going, "You guys get double scale." He goes, "Well, don't you care about what Herbie's making? You're just always going to get double scale here." And I go, "Yes, you know, yes, sir, yes, sir."
Yeah.
So that was kind of a lesson learned. But Herbie came down and did his Herbie thing, and then I got a call to go up to with David Rubinson. Up to what was the name of the Herbie Hancock Studios up in San Francisco?
Don't know, man. Sorry.
I sound something, or it wasn't Fantasy, but so I'd go out. Freddie Washington and I went up there, and we did Light Up the Night. I think there was a record, and Rod Temperton had written a couple of tunes, and then I did another Herbie record the next year down here, and then, you know, a few years back we did Possibilities.
So you've had a very long relationship with him.
And I've played live with Herbie on, you know, multiple, you know, if I can get Vinny ever out of there. But Vinny works well with Herbie, so that's a really great marriage. But I've done a lot of benefits with Herbie, and it's just so much fun just to be with.
Do you have a preference? Like, you've had the really good fortune of doing both, which is like emotionally and mental and physically healthy and creatively healthy to play both live and studio. Is there a preference that you have, or?
You know, that's a great, I ask myself that question a lot when we go out with David now. And because when we're out with David, it's just like we're in the studio, because it's just, we've got everything, all the best possible situation with OSA audio and you know, my mix is just ridiculous. So it's almost like I am in the studio, and all the studio work I've done. Do I miss it? Yeah, there are times where it would be nice to be able to get back into the guys. But I think, you know, in starting to get into that this last quarter of life, playing live is very important. And, you know, as I've got a studio here.
Yeah, yeah, totally get it. Herb Alpert, man, talk about a talent and a half.
Ooh. God, I met him when it was the A of A&M.
Oh, wow.
You know, Albert and Moss. And, you know, I'd be over working with Lionel in Studio B, and he'd be over in C, and he'd go, JR, can you come over and do an overdub real quick? And I'm thinking, all right, I'm getting double paid. You know, he goes, yeah, bring the cymbal and bring a snare drum. So I do my thing and blah, blah, blah. Come back. And he goes, no. I just figured you just do it for free.
You're kidding me.
Oh, there was a bunch of that shit went down. And then, but I did a whole bunch of Herb Albert records. So
okay, so that was your pay. So you had an investment, and then you got the investment paid off. Yeah.
He and I got on extremely well. And we had just played with him. He can still play his ass off, by the way. We did a tribute to Quincy Jones last year.
Mm.
And there was a Hal Blaine. I don't know if I'm confusing my specials. No, there was a Hal Blaine tribute. And A Taste of Honey.
Great,
and it was the whole thing with Hal stomping it off. And so I had to nail that. And Herb just looked at me and smiled. And
that's cool.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
I have somebody, I have his engineer coming, or one of his engineers. Do you know Benny Facone?
Benny Facone.
Yeah, Benny Facone. Yeah, he's coming on the show.
Montreal.
Yeah, right. I think he's done a lot of work with Herb. He's coming on like soon, I think, this week.
Oh, is he? Oh, give me, because he lives like right around the corner. Looks close. Oh, and he had gone to Berkeley also.
Yes, he did. And then he went up to Montreal after. Let me just make a note.
That's right. He went to LA Studio. Yeah.
Yep. That's so fun. It's a very small world, man, isn't it?
Oh, with Benny, Jesus. I did Luis Miguel and with Juan Carlos Calderon and probably 250,
sessions,
Hispanic records, probably.
Wow. Yeah. He's got massive, in the, Latin community with the,
yeah.
Bob Seger.
Woo.
I mean, not for nothing, man. What a real feather in your cap. What diversity. It's not only just like the diversity, but like, this is like the A-list guys in each niche, man. I mean, honestly, that's so cool that you've done that. You know, you really not blowing smoke up your ass, but I'm just saying it's something to feel proud of, because it's like when you look back at what you've done, it's like, man, this is very musically important stuff that you've worked on, you know. So congratulations, in all seriousness, this is great.
Thanks. Yeah. Bob was great. I got a call real quickly from Russ Kunkel. Russ was doing the Like a Rock record, and Russ goes, I got out of the gig, man. You got to bail me out. I go, okay. It was Bob Seger. I go, oh, great. I always loved Ramblin' Gamblin' Man in 1968.
Yeah, that old stuff was great of his.
It was great. And you know, he was kind of an R&B rock singer from Detroit.
Yeah.
So I go, okay, I get in there, and I'm working with this Silver Bullet band. And I didn't realize, you know, I was always been a snare whore. And I'd have deep old Ludwig snare drums and stuff. I didn't realize that they were doing 25 takes per song with fat, deep snares.
Oh my God.
Takes two, take three. Oh man, this is great. And look at the guys are thumbing me up, getting into take eight. And finally I talked to the Punch Andrews producer guy, and I go, what's wrong with that take? He goes, nothing. Let's do another one. So 25 takes per song.
That was just their system, like.
Yes.
Wow.
That was hell.
Who came up with that? That sounds like something the studio owner would come up with.
It was Punch Andrews, his manager.
Wow.
And I'm going, well, this is a one-off, you know. And Bob goes, man, I want you to join the band and move to Lake Michigan, and I go, no. So that was, you know, I enjoyed it.
That particular record, Rick, what's his name? Wasn't
Vito?
Rick Vito was on that, right?
Yeah, Rick Vito.
Yeah, I had him on my show ages ago. He's the guy who did the slide on Like a Rock. It's like the most famous slide lick ever.
Yeah, Rick's great.
Yeah, he's great. Man, you talk about a guy, that guy is like, I think he's 70. He looks like he's like 45, man. He's in great, you know, good looking guy, great shape, man. He got hit with the good genes.
See, now we don't have to wear jeans anymore because we're all isolated.
Man, I see this on Facebook all the time. Everybody's like,
it's like David Letterman world now. We can all be pantsless.
Yeah, yeah. At the end of this interview, JR will show you his pantsless.
Yes.
Did you work with Frank Sinatra? You did, right?
Yeah, I met Frank first with we did a gig in Palm Springs for his wife, where there were three big bands. It was the Quincy Jones band, the Sinatra band, and I can't remember the other band. It could have been the Herman band or something, but that's the first time I'd met Frank. And then the only thing I ever did was, I think it was on, it's really ironic, I replaced Steve Gadd's drums on some, I think LA Is My Lady, but not that song. It's on that record.
That's funny.
So I basically came in and overdubbed over Steve Gadd. I go,
what's up with that?
Hey. I even looked at Quincy. I go, really?
Was Frank, was it intimidating? You know, he's such like an intimidating.
He was not there.
Oh, he was not there. Okay.
He was not there at that point.
You've done a shit ton of really cool movies. What was your first like entry into that? And how did that aspect of your career grow? Because, I mean, you've worked on just like tremendous.
Well, like yourself, you spread yourself with revenue stream. And, you know, at my disposal was I was a union musician and I can read my ass off. So and I can be a chameleon, which is perfect for the motion picture and TV world and jingles. So
there's a lot of reading on that. And in fact, that's the key to your success, as far as I understand.
Definitely. You've got to be an A reader and see these notes and don't be afraid of them and stuff. So I think I got a call from a contractor. And I'm not sure the exact call, but I know Neil Steubenhaus was instrumental in helping me break into the TV and film world. And I know that I did a session with Ron Howard called Night Shift.
Oh, yeah, sure.
With what's his name? Fonzie.
Henry Winkler.
Henry Winkler and Michael Keaton, I think. And
yeah, that's right. He was like a nurse in there, I think, Michael Keaton.
I think Burt Bacharach wrote some shit in that movie. Yeah. And we had a song, Rufus had a song in the movie. And I did, that was one of the first ones I did. And then I kind of broke in. I mean, I started doing these films, which was really cool, working with like Tom Newman and different things. And then I started doing some of the Simpsons episodes where they brought me in thinking that I'm a great mallet player. And I'll never forget because Bob Zemini was doubling on drum set, but it was a left-handed set because Bob was left-handed. And I go, I'm the drummer. I should be playing drums. They go, JR, go play a xylophone. Oh, fuck.
Do you know how to play? Did you know how to play xylophone?
I did.
Okay.
My second instrument at Berkeley were mallets, but I hated it because, you know, as much as it is like a piano, you're still dealing with, you know, fingering out distances.
Yeah.
And I suck. So I go, put me on timpani. You know, let me play piatti, timpani, and snare drum and all this other stuff. So I learned right there that I'm not going to be playing mallets, right. You know, for the Oscars.
That's, yeah, but at least you spoke up, man.
Well, Well, you know, when you're, it's a C sharp and it's not.
Yeah, I hear you, man. Anyone else that you want to chat about that was cool or funny or interesting story?
Yeah. Peter Frampton.
Yeah, let's do that.
Peter Frampton became and still is a very good friend of mine. And back when I lived in Agoura Hills, I lived way out in the country in this beautiful thing. And the Lakers had just won the 1987 championship. And I was very Magic Johnson. He was a friend of mine. And I'm just, you know, I'm probably boozed up and celebrating and hooping and hollering. And all of a sudden my phone rings. You know, I thought it was going to be like Phil and Gaines or somebody.
To talk about the game.
Yeah. You know, like, oh, wow, where'd you go? What about that place? You know?
Yeah.
He goes, hey, hello, it's Peter. Peter Frampton. I go, no fucking way. Oh, man, you're just, somebody's joshing me about the Lakers. No, it's really Peter Frampton. I go, oh. Oh, I go, you know, I was just watching the Lakers. He goes, I don't watch basketball. You're giving me all this shit, like there goes my balloon.
Yeah, your head is like, yeah.
He goes, I would really love you to come in and play. And I went in and recorded with him the next week, and it was great. And we went and we played right after that, the Arsenio Hall show. And I think it was, the record was called When All the Pieces Fit. And you know, we had massive long hair. We all had long hair. And there's a video of that from the Arsenio Hall show. It is rocking.
Arsenio
Hall. It is just on fire. And I'm thinking, this is great. I've always had this fantasy to, you know, have a, you know, be with a rock guitar player, you know, and to play. It's not just R&B, you know, it's like rock and roll. And, you know, I grew up in Iowa playing rock and roll. So,
what's his name? Tommy Boland from Iowa.
Tommy was from Sioux City, I think.
Yeah.
I never got to meet Tommy, unfortunately.
Yeah. Sioux City, yeah. Okay, sorry about that.
Imagine if he stayed alive. Holy shit.
What an amazing, incredible guy. I mean, I don't know why he's not mentioned more often, but you listen to all the stuff he did. It's just, even the stuff with Deep Purple was freaking amazing.
Ridiculous. Yeah. Even though Steve is unbelievable in Deep Purple right now.
So. Oh, yeah. Steve, and he's also a very nice, lovely guy, man.
Well, you know, and Ian and I are very close.
He's supposed to be coming on here.
Oh, you got it. You should. It's too bad we can't have oysters, because Ian and I are oyster bros. But, you know, getting back to Frampton, then later as time went on and the 90s came along, I got a call. We had already done 4 records together, and I turned them on to Chris Lord-Alge, the engineer, and Chris should say thank you very much, because he made a shitload of dough from Peter.
There you go.
But I got a call from Miles Copeland.
Stuart Copeland's brother, the manager of the Police.
And he was managing Peter, and he goes, yeah, I need you to come in and let's talk about the tour. I go, what tour? He goes, well, you want to go on tour? I go, yeah. I come on in. So I walk in, and it reminded me of one of those James Bond shots of the Spectre, and you can't see the guy's
Spectre.
It's like this.
Yeah.
or it's like this. And he had like a Persian cat on him, and I was trying to negotiate with him, but I couldn't see him. You know, it was like one of those things.
Oh, because it was the light was behind him or something?
No, it's just, it was, I don't know. It was how I envisioned Miles Copeland.
That's so funny.
So I made my deal, and all right, we'll talk about it. All right, you can go. So I go, and you know, of course I got the deal.
Okay.
And we went out with Peter for a little over 6 months. And it was great with John Regan and the late great Bob Mayo.
Bob Mayo.
That was a true rock band. And we did Frampton Comes Alive 2. And that's on video. And I highly recommend that, even to this day. I'm still playing a single kick pedal. No bullshit.
When was that tour?
It was 96.
Okay.
And we did that at the Fillmore West.
That's so cool.
We recorded it.
What a great... you know, you probably listened to that as a kid a million times. You know, what a great opportunity.
I got tired of Frampton Comes Alive 1 because I guess I don't know. I think there's too many girls liked it.
That's really cool, man. Who, tell me the artist, player, producer, or even mentor that you have learned the most from, and can you maybe give some examples of some of the things you learned? Could be about music, could be about business, could be about life, whatever you want to
talk about. Quincy Jones, and you know, he's the best. He would say things to you like, you know, leave your ego at the door. You know, if I was like fucking up, he'd just come out and on my chart or on a blank piece of paper, write 2 bars of something and split. And I'm looking at it and I'm going, oh. So, you know, implement his production was unlike anything. And he would come in, if the rhythm section was failing, he would come in and say things like, you got to stroke the pussy. and then turn around and walk out. I mean, he wouldn't smile. He'd just turn around and walk, sit back down. And all of us are like, what'd he say? And all of a sudden, and then the next take, we got it.
Interesting.
So, but his knowledge and his history has definitely rubbed off. His production techniques have rubbed off on me. His perfection, his kindness, his compatibility, his love, you know. So he's the high point.
You know, I saw the documentary about him. I thought I had a decent work ethic, but like, I've never seen any human being like work like that.
Right.
It's you can't compete with that. And nobody, there's a reason why he's been so prolific.
That's right.
You know, hats off to him. Tough question. Top three experiences you've had musically.
Oof. I mean, when I was in high school, I won an award, which it was some place in Indiana called the Arion Award, A-R-I-O-N. And it's some guy named Arion, I guess, who presented high school musicians an outstanding award. So I won that award, and that made me feel recognized, even though I wasn't trying to win an award. So that was one. The second one was joining Rufus that night because of that break. And, you know, I mean, there's the third one, you could put a lot of stuff into it. Like, you know, We Are the World, sure, that was great and everything. But, you know, winning a Grammy with Rufus was great, too. But I would say Steve Winwood. Working with Steve Winwood, because, you know, a lot of people, I mean, to me, he is the epitome of British royalty in rock and roll, and kind of an unsung hero for it. And we did two records with him back in the High Life, you know, with Higher Love and all that.
God, what a great record.
And then the second one was Roll With It. And I got to play with Tony Levin on that. But the first record, it's like Dark Side of the Moon to me. It's like the shit.
That's so cool, man. I saw him, I think he was playing with Santana or open for Santana, and he came and joined Carlos on stage. He's a hell of a guitar player.
Yeah. Yeah. I never knew him as a guitar player.
You know? I was shocked how, like, he was really tasty, man. You know, I mean, he's not like a shredder, but he knows how to play great, man.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. He's ridiculous.
You know, it's interesting. When I asked that question, probably half of the people I asked that question to, their first response is always very similar to yours. The first time I got this award in high school, or the first time my high school band that I played in played to a major club, that the nostalgia and validation of that is really strong.
You just made me forget about something. I'm going to have a 3+.
Yeah, man, go ahead. Of course.
Back in 69, my junior high jazz band won the Mid-America Jazz Festival.
That's big stuff, man.
First time we made a record and I was ever recorded. So I've got that record. That's like, I forgot about that. So I guess I get 3.5. So.
Yeah, man, that's perfect. Is there anything you haven't done musically that you want to do?
I mean, you know, living in Hollywood, there's this competition with Oscar songs, which are generally just awful. They pick awful songs. And the Gonna Be All Right song that Maya and I wrote for the Bronx USA, we did submit it to the Oscars, but they've got their powwow of yo-hos that they're selecting from.
Is there a lot of nepotism in that?
Yeah,
I'm sure.
And, you know, we're also, us composers are going to be up for an Emmy for this film, which, hey, you never know. That would be good.
Let's talk about that. So JR scored a movie, or a good chunk of it, called The Bronx USA. And I know you're really proud of that. So talk about that. How did you get involved in it? How did it come about? And, you know, just whatever you want to talk about it, man.
Well, I got involved because my friend Danny Gold, who is the film director for that movie, we did a movie a couple of years before called If You're Not in the Obit, Eat Breakfast. And that that movie was with Carl Reiner and, you know, Mel Brooks and Dick Van Dyke and Betty White. And so it's all these old people that are still really, really, really active. And so we were like a band in the film, which was great. And we did a thing with Dick Van Dyke. And so that led into this next movie and asking. And it was actually the first time I'd scored legitly for a film. And, you know, and I'm set up in the studio here. So it was a bit of a learning curve. But I was thrown music that was within my wheelhouse that then I can embellish and make the film better because of that. So I did like 9 or 10 cues and then had 2 songs in the film too.
That's really cool, man. What did you, what did you get most out of that experience?
I think the end result, when people that weren't even with us that saw the movie, it touched them. So to be a part of a large group that basically you're it's like intimate, even though there's a whole bunch of people that takes to make a film, to know that that's touched people. I think that's what the best part of it is.
That's nice, man. And that you created it from nothing.
Well, I mean, I had inspiration via film. So, you know,
what I mean, but you created the music.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, that's really cool, man.
Yeah.
Any low points, JR, dark periods you've had to deal with? And how'd you get through them? You're smiling, so let's go.
Have you and I been outside lately? Hey, you know, I have a fucking PA system in the garage. I thought about just, I'm on a cul-de-sac. Going to bring the PA system outside, put a bunch of fucking microphones up and maybe masks and have people start coming in singing. You know, I don't know. But, you know, the old days, listen, when I first joined Rufus in 1978, nobody knew who I was.
Yeah.
Nobody. I didn't have hardly any endorsements. I think the first endorsement I had was Slingerland Drums. I was struggling to get a Remo Drumhead endorsement.
Wow.
And, you know, and I almost thought there could have been a prejudice thing going on, even though I'm white. You know, I was in a black band and, you know, maybe certain companies perceive you differently that way. But I don't know if that's true or not.
Sure.
But during those days when I joined Rufus, we had a solo deal with ABC Dunhill. And ABC Dunhill was the Crusaders, Steely Dan, and Steppenwolf.
Wow.
And us. And we were the holdovers. And then all that merger went to MCA. And that's why you saw all of us go over to MCA, and which we used to call Music Cemetery of America.
Oh, bad, huh?
They totally fucked everybody. And but before that, we had done this one record called Numbers on ABC Dunhill. And I helped like bring Freddie Hubbard in because I had known him. And I was learning. It was my very first real record. And I was learning how to not, you know, I'm coming out of Billy Cobham world live. I'm playing hard and fast. And I had to learn how to not overload sound pressure and microphones. And that was a curve. And the engineer, Roy Halley from Simon and Garfunkel, hit me to how to control sound pressure. But the dark point was nobody knew who I was. And I was trying to get other gigs. And Rufus wasn't paying me hardly anything.
Really?
So I was using my basketball chops, going to Balboa Park in the Valley and hustling basketball. And I met a kid named Tommy Cedros was his name. And, you know, he always was high. And I made friends with him. And we would hustle 2-on-2. You know, I'd make $5, $10.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's how I got by for a little while.
Wow. Holy shit, man. Wow, that is amazing.
They couldn't beat us. And then I got invited on the weekend with Jackie Jackson, Michael's older brother,
yeah,
to come out and play with the real ballers. And, you know, they're hitting each other in the face and shit. And I go, man, I am not doing that. you know, so I bailed on that.
Yeah. Wow.
That was dark.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, man, I mean, but you know, you do, what you got to do.
Yeah.
You know? And it's good. That, hey, at least you had that talent that you could fall back on.
Yeah. Of course now, you know, I can't jump a quarter of an inch,
but you don't need to, thank God. Right.
I don't know. Maybe.
Anything else?
You know, I mean, I went through two bad divorces, which was, you know, not great on the children.
Yeah, and I'm sure.
I've got three beautiful boys, John, Chris, and Jack. And, you know, I don't know if it's made them stronger or weaker, but I'm hoping stronger.
Yeah.
I still have great relationships with the kids. You know, Jack still lives here half the time.
Oh, great.
He's a great drummer. You know, it was just a lot of wasted effort and monies dealing with the court systems. And I was kind of suckered into that crap. So,
the thing with divorce is getting married is difficult enough. There's no rule book, but at least it organically, it feels like you're moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
Getting divorced, because I've got divorced once many, many years ago. There's no frame of reference to unwind that, man. It's really, you know, degrees of loss on all levels.
No, and then we'll put this puppy to bed. One idea was, there was one set of attorneys that wanted to come in my garage and measure my cables that are in a fucking box.
Because that's an asset.
That's an asset, baby. Here, I got a cable for you.
Oh, yeah, man. That is sick.
Anyway, we're putting that one to bed.
Yeah, man.
It was another quick, dark time. However, I got compensated well. Was Lenny Warnerker, again from Warner Brothers, called me and he goes, "You got a band, right, JR?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, John Fogerty's looking for a band. Why don't you give him a call? Or he's going to call you." I go, "Okay, cool." He calls me up, and this was 85, early 86, 85, something like that. And he goes, I want you to be my drummer, and you've got a band, so let's go. It's like, just like that. I go, okay. He goes, but let's go down and let's rehearse the blues first. I hired Steuben House, Marty Walsh, and Alan Pasqua was my
Marty
band.
Walsh? Where did you know him from, Berkeley?
Marty and I had a rock band out here.
Because he's originally, he's originally from L.A.
With Billy Sherwood.
Yeah, yeah, I had him on the show. We had a
couple of bands, Marty. And Marty used to be one of our guitar players that would come in and out of the session world.
Okay, right, right.
And now he's at Berkeley, and I kind of helped. I wrote his acceptance letter to get him in. And
oh, cool, and man. And
Marty's on fire, man. He's like king out there. So
yeah, he's having a good
time. But we had a good band, and we couldn't play any Creedence tunes. And I used to love Creedence because he was getting sued by Saul Zance. And so we went out and we did this record called Eye of the Zombie.
Yeah.
It's just dark shit.
Yeah, it was very dark.
And you know, we'd have people throw shit at us in these shed tours.
What, just because he wasn't playing Creedence?
That's right.
And nobody realized at the time he wasn't allowed to play Creedence.
He couldn't even talk about it. So that was, wow. it was a bit of a dark moment.
That being said, it was a pretty good record. It is pretty dark. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything that you've done that at the time was out of your comfort zone, but you did it anyway, and it turned out to be a big break for you?
Hmm. Oof. That's a tough one. I can't really think of anything. I've always been able to adapt. And I mean, you know, I this is not even related, but I've had like Christoph Beck, the film composer, you know, who we did the Hangovers and stuff. We were doing something, I don't know, it was Dodgeball or something, and he had written for two bass drums. Like, literally, I had to read the fucking bass drum part.
Oh, he wrote two bass drums for you, knowing it was just you.
Yes. And I go, man, this is some hard shit. Because, like, you know, these guys write from their finger programming. And so I had to go in there and try to go, I go, oh, dude, I'm not going to be able to play that. So, I mean, I'm not going to be playing in some 17-4 band.
Yeah, yeah.
Some avant-garde weird thing. So,
You've always been really, I don't know you, but it seems like you've always had a comfortable level of confidence in what you can do. And I bet that helped you get gigs, because people feel, you know, it's like when you go to the doctor, man, if you go to somebody that's like, makes you feel you're in good hands, it's like, that's how you feel, you know? And right. I bet that served you really well.
It's been good. And you know what? It's been good to have be a master of confidence, you know, and I think it's important, not only with drummers, but, you know, all musicians, you know, they sometimes, and I see guys, you can see timid people. And what you want to do is make sure. And when I do, on occasion, do private teaching, I try to teach confidence. And, you know, and if you can't play like Vinny, who gives a fuck?
You know, yeah.
Play like yourself. You know, fucking nobody plays like Vinny. So,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, don't, I mean, he's somebody to compare, but not really. You know, he's on another planet. So play like yourself.
No, I think that's great advice. And I think that I've talked to so many people that's musicians that suffer from like imposter syndrome. It's like the opposite of that, where they feel like, man, I hope I don't get outed.
Right.
When they don't need to feel like that, it's just like, you know, but yeah, I think that confidence has really served you well.
Yeah. Thank you.
Favorite guitarists and bass players you've enjoyed playing with? God, you've got a list.
Larry Carlton. Dean Parks, Lukather, Landau. Landau always reminded me of a guitar player that comps like a keyboard player.
Yeah, he's a great player, man.
With Landau. Paul Jackson, indirectly Nile Rodgers. Because we've never physically been in the same room together, except in the old days when Sheik would open up for Rufus, which was some fun days.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Michael Thompson, you know, I've had like five rock bands with Michael. James Hera, just one of the most soulful cats there is. Peter Frampton, to me, is the probably greatest unsung guitar player on the planet today. And people need to really listen to his playing. You know, the legends with Clapton. I always liked Eric because he was understated. He understated his playing. He didn't play too much. You know, unlike, you know, some of these other flurry guys. And I know there's a bunch of guitar players I'm forgetting. But bass players, you know, Nathan East has always been at the top of the list. Neil Steubenhaus. Neil's time is better than any bass players I've ever played with, ever.
That's amazing.
His time is absolutely precise. Abraham Laboriel Sr. has this thing about him that makes you dance. And it's really kind of fun to play with. You know, we did the rhythm of the night. And then we did All Night Long, All Night. Which were both similar. Freddie Washington, great bass player. Stanley Clark. Stanley Clark is funny because we had cut a number one record with Clark Duke called Sweet Baby, and he's playing really short, and he's looking at me. He goes, "What do you think?" And I go, "Well," he goes, "what do you think of my bass part?" And he's asking me. And I go, "It's great." I go, "You know, you are muting a lot of the notes." He goes, "Oh, should I not mute so many?" I go, "No, I don't think you should mute so many."
Oh, so he didn't. And he went back and did it over.
Well, kind of. But I mean, if you listen to it, it is what it is.
Yeah.
And God, what other bass players? Who else do I play with? It's funny. We're always looking for newer bass players. I want to play with that kid on Facebook who's 10. That kid.
I haven't seen him. There's so many. I was at NAMM and they had kids there like that.
This kid looks like he's like maybe Filipino or something. I don't know, man. He plays the cross between like Rocco and it's just amazing. And Jocko and anything Jocko.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. Some talented young kids out there, man. Today, some 50 years after you started, what fuels your obsession to play still?
I feel that, I mean, when I walk around my house and see my drum set, it's like a good woman, and I need to play it.
I hear you, that, man.
And it doesn't yell back at me. And
a good woman doesn't yell.
Okay, then. Wow, look at the time. It's just like just the spontaneity of playing on cymbals and drums and stuff coming back at you and you know, maybe trying something that I'd not tried before. So it keeps me fluid. And, you know, I write, you know, from the keyboard guitar perspective. I don't always, matter of fact, I rarely write from the drums perspective. So then if I'm writing something that's really stiff, I know that I can always put drums on it. I don't have to go to one of those drum programs.
Yeah, yeah.
I've saved money there.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. You don't write from a drum perspective. Well, I guess that's that would be appropriate because you're writing for drums. So yeah, but that's interesting. I never thought of that. Man, tell me your top three Desert Island discs. No particular order, just for this minute.
This is hard. Billy Cobham, Spectrum. God, I think I even wrote anything from Frank Sinatra. And Buddy Rich, Big Swing Face. I like the Sinatra, kind of the medium year days, you know, with the Basie Orchestra, you know, and that kind of the shit that was swinging hard. So.
And what's the Buddy record? Big Swing Face?
Big Swing Face. Yeah. It was recorded live at the Shea in Hollywood.
Tell me best decision you ever made, JR.
Ooh. Joining Rufus.
Yeah, that really was a pivotal thing for your whole career, wasn't it, man?
It did. It changed everything. I mean, you know, and I was gracious. I mean, I met Jeff Porcaro, and Jeff was gracious enough to allow me in and not have any sort of jealousy or qualms or anything. And you know, it was because this is his town. Yeah. This was Jeff Porcaro's town. And even though Keltner, you know, was always here, but it was Jeff's town. And, you know, he was incredibly nice to me. And ironically, later, Rufus and Toto were managed by Fitzgerald Hartley together.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which was a night. We were always just one big family, so it was kind of cool. So, yeah, joining Rufus was it.
Are you good with, like, balancing your time between, you know, work and not work?
Definitely.
You are. That's great, man. How have you done that?
Well, you know, you can ask any session player. There's not that much work. But just sometimes shit gets forced on you. But yeah. You know, I mean, even if like I was doing in the golden days, three different artists a day with running three drum sets around town, that gets old. And, you know, you have to learn to back off and take a breath. That's why, you know, outside when it's nice out, I just wrote a song yesterday, which is my copyright called Liquid Office. I have a jacuzzi and I call it the Liquid Office. And
oh,
I
go right out there. On.
And I get all these ideas. There's something about the water. I don't know what it is. And but I wrote this really hip song this week, and it allows me to, you know, to get away. You know, and I was gardening. I think I'm going to put in a garden soon. Now that we're confined,
yeah.
And I'm really into vinyl, and I've got multiple areas of my house. Excuse me, where there's vinyl setups, and I've become a hi-fi snob, even though I can't afford to be like one of those Yoho hi-fi snobs. You know what? Oh, my speakers are 40 grand.
Yeah, that's a little nutty, man. You don't need 40 grand groups, speakers. Yeah.
And these guys are, they need a beating.
So that's cool that you've been able to balance things.
And football. I'm, you know, if you've noticed, I'm a,
yeah, I saw your Chiefs shirt there, man.
I'm a major Chiefs fan, and all my balloons are still inflated from the Super Bowl, so that means something.
What do you think? What's his? Tom Brady just came down here to Tampa. What do you think of that?
Well, first of all, you guys had a good team, you know.
Yeah.
And you know that? Did you bet your ass that they're going to protect his ass on that offensive line? So what? You know, the day Tom goes down is, you know, bye bye Tom.
Oh yeah.
So I think it's, You know, and ironically, we do come play you guys, I think. We're going to
play. The Chiefs are playing down here? Or,
yeah.
Oh, really?
I don't know. I have to find the schedule. I don't know if it's up there or down there. But I'm just glad he's out of New England.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because New England, they got all real full of themselves. And, you know, and it's some special. We just came and kicked their ass twice. So it's like, there's a new sheriff in town.
Do you follow, do you go to road games and shit?
I used to go back to Arrowhead when I could afford it. Yeah, because I have friends with boxes.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's, you know, unless you're there and it's, you know, 10 degrees below zero, which is uncomfortable. But, I'm a major supporter of the team.
That's really cool, man. Tough question. What do you like most about yourself?
Ooh. That's a good question. I guess I've learned what my parents instilled in me, and I'm applying that.
Which is?
I guess patience and love and knowledge.
That's cool, man. It sounds like you had a really good childhood. You seem like you have some very fond memories of your folks and stuff like that.
Oh, it was fantastic. Even after they got divorced when I was seven, you know, we still had a, you know, small town working thing. It was good.
Yeah. Well, you say your dad was four houses away or four blocks away or something like
that? Yeah, four blocks away.
Yeah, that's pretty nice that they were able to work that out for you guys, man, for you and your sister.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wasn't able to actually get custody with him. And back in those days, the father couldn't get custody.
Oh, I know. I went through this back in the early 90s.
And ironically, he tried to get custody of the only me, which was kind of weird, I thought.
Happiest time in your life?
Ooh. Well, is that not counting when the Chiefs won the Super Bowl?
Whatever, if that's the happiest, it's whatever it is.
There's a whole bunch of them. I can't, you know, when winning the Grammy on stage with the band was really, really rewarding.
Yeah.
I'm just grateful, you know, now, you know, these days just to wake up, you know, and be on the north side of the dirt.
Yeah, man. That's just what happens, I think, as you get older. That's important, man, you know?
Yeah.
You have any non-musical superpowers?
That's funny because my oldest son is like really into superheroes. I swear to God, you'd probably ask him, he'd be like, yeah, he goes, I'm this guy from that. I'm very good at reading people. So I think I'm good. I'm a good diffuser of conflict.
Man, I cannot imagine how that served you in your business, man. When you walk in and you're in a session, because you got to assess that shit pretty quickly. Who's who, and you know who's the dad, and who's like, you know, how to interface and you know back off and not back off. You know, that's a very important skill.
Right.
How do you think? How did you get that?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I remember in high school, I was a good physics student.
So, physics?
That's a different subject. Yeah, I mean, I was always really just busy all the time. So always occupying brain space.
Yeah.
You know, and not getting bored. I was a terrible reader, though, like books. I hated reading books because of my vision. And,
your bad vision?
Well, I'm plus, and my dad was an optometrist, so he'd do little things when I was a kid where I'd have to wear patches. Right now, I'm wearing a plus 5.5 and a plus 6.
Oh, contacts!
So I can see the hair on a flea.
Yeah,
but my muscles would get sore when I'd read, and they still do. So, I was never really a good book reader.
Man, you know what I had a few years back? I had LASIKs because I wore contact lens, and they did one eye. So one is for distance, and the other one. And so what happens is it took a while. It generally only takes 2-3 months, but it took like 6 or 7 for me to them to adapt so you could sort of see things.
Oh, wow.
It was, and it's the best thing I ever did because I hated it. I was wearing contacts for so many years, and it was just nice to put them down.
Yeah. Well, good for you.
Yeah, lucky about that. Outside of gardening, and vinyl. Any other hobbies?
I like cars.
Old cars or new cars?
Well, now in my present situation, both are older. But if I somehow found a fountain of gold, I would have a lot more cars. So I've always been a car guy. And, you know, I mean, I've driven a Bugatti Veyron before.
What's that like?
Oh, shit. Driving a jet on, you know, in linear fashion, you know, with just X and Y, you know, no Z axis. So it was very, very, very hip. But that's a tough habit.
Yeah. Expensive habit.
Expensive habit. So.
Yeah. Hey, two more questions. Toughest decision you've had to make or most difficult thing you've had to do?
Ooh. Wow. God, that's a, I don't know if I can answer that. I mean, you know, somehow you led me into this Barbara Streisand thing, but, it was, you know, it was all good. This is kind of a sad story, but, we were playing, in Berlin at Hitler's outdoor complex with wow. Barbara Streisand. Just a beautiful place. I mean, if you really looked at it from that angle.
Yeah, yeah.
And, we're on stage, and I think it's where the Berlin Philharmonic plays outdoors and shit. It's all out in the country, and there's all these tunnels that Hitler could run away in the old days. And Barbara's looking up, and she goes, "What are those things up there?" And she didn't know what they were. They were turrets, gun turrets. So... But that wasn't it. It was my sister, Judy, was dying, and she had a cancer sarcoma of the left hip. Oh, and I was out on the road in Europe with Barbara. Well, you know, I ended up putting a smile on my face. So we're done with the concert, and I knew shit was happening, and I could see the management all come out, and I go, and so it was blah, blah, starts crying and shit. So they flew me overnight back to San Antonio via Paris, and the whole band went to Sweden, and she canceled the show. And she said she had a cough. I honest to God think she was doing that for me. And the whole band was at some fucking vodka ice house getting plastered, sending me pictures where I'm burying my sister in San Antonio. Oh, but so I fly back and meet the band in Manchester, England. And it was almost like I wasn't in the band anymore. I felt really disconnected. But I'm playing, and then at the very end, Barbara, she designated the song, what was it? Oh, shit, I'll think of it in a second. And I had to play Brushes on it, and I'll think of it. But I just bawled my eyes out while I'm playing this, and it was...
dedicated it to the memory of your sister.
And
that's heavy, man.
And it was like, that was kind of the hardest thing. I shouldn't remember the song. I'm probably blacking it out for a reason.
But, no, that's heavy, man. That's
it was like, I'm playing my ass off, and tears are like blowing all over the snare drum, you know?
Man, I'm sorry.
You know, that was a tough one. But, yeah. You know, I mean, I always try to stay jovial about stuff.
Yeah. Wow. Wow, that's heavy. Sorry, man.
That's all right.
And then biggest change in your personality, JR, over the last 10 years, and how much of that has been intentional and how much is just a part of aging?
When I was getting into – I had a record deal – in 89 on WTG CBS Sony with a guy named Mark Williamson. It was called Bridge Too Far, and Lionel threw us our private party, and it was blah, blah. And so I was thinking, great, I'm going to be out of sessions, you know, fuck this shit. I'm moving on. And then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the record company goes, well, we have to spend all our money on Richard Marx. Where we can't, and you guys, and I'm thinking, oh shit. So we're doing more sessions, and I'm on a session with Dean Parks. And Dean Parks, and I'm really antsy, and I'm going through a divorce, and I think I'm short-tempered. And Nile Rodgers used to say of me, I'd leave my car running while I did a session, and which was not true. And so I'm playing, and apparently I was a little quick to jump, and, you know, probably angered and probably voiced it to whomever, producers or players or whatever. And Dean Parks grabbed me and took me aside and said, you know, I know you're going through some shit, and you know, you need to try to just calm down and be yourself and relax. And if they ask to do another take, and don't worry about it. And those are some of the greatest words that I was ever told. So, you know, from that point on, I became, I think, more aware of the people around me. And, you don't want to piss people off. You know, you're working with and playing with people. So I think I learned that is like, that. You know, don't let your ego get in the way of this. This is just human one-on-one, you know, and this is all we have.
Yeah. And that's a tough situation to be in, man, because that is such an emotional, like guys are measuring your cables.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, I wasn't surprised when you said, it's just the absurdity of it all, like, is really painful. Plus the kids and all, man, I get it, man.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, first of all, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. It's really kind of you. And I want to just tell people, remind people about the Bronx USA soundtrack that you're really proud of. Where can people see that movie?
It's, I think it's native to HBO.
Okay, native to HBO.
Well, I think you can buy it now, too. And, you know, you can download it through all the avenues.
Okay. So you could stream it, and it's on HBO. If you have HBO, you could check it out there. And he recorded at his studio, which, as I said before, sounds better than Capitol. also, if, man, do you want to talk about, you do a lot of producing and engineering out of your studio. You want to talk about some of that?
Yeah, I mean, my engineering is per. I am not the final engineer because if I, but you know, I'm running a digital console. I'm running a Yamaha DM2000, a VCM console, which is a 4 or 5 layered console. And you got to understand about, you know, digital audio or digital analog back to digital in your IOs and all this different stuff. Not only that, and you know, Pro Tools. So I'm sponsored by Avid, thank God, because they've been really instrumental in all the work I've done, and it's kind of like the mainstay. So, you know, you have to understand about engineering and about sounds and about frequencies and about latency and about all this other stuff. But I've been producing for a long time now, and I think one of the first things, I mean, I've been a co-producer in Rufus, and then I moved on, and I produced a song called Hit the Road Jack that Ray Charles did for this girl. And we did, it was like during the dance movement in like the mid-80s, you know, and it's really cool. I play it now in violin. I didn't play drums. It was all programmed back in those days. But I've always been a part of a producer of something. And, you know, by working with the great Quincy Jones and the other great David Foster, who to me are both the two best producers of all time, the stuff rubs off, and you know, learning how to do that, you know, then hopefully make other people, you know, better at what they do.
Who would be, if someone's listening, what would be an ideal person or group or band or artist that you'd fit well with, that where you could add value to them as a producer?
Oof. Is Queen reuniting? you know, it's, and one singer I've always loved is Paul Rodgers, but you know, I think a lot of these guys are like semi, like out retired. You know, and I went through my Zeppelin days, but you know, I could easily fit into U2, and I would want to take Larry's gig.
Yeah,
and I love Larry, by the way; he's a good guy. But you know, that kind of a band would be cool. I mean, that's why I love the Frampton band so much, because it was, you know, the same voices.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit more of a, you know, humble pie vibe, you know.
So, like, so a rock band is really going to be your forte.
I like, well, I like rock bands. I mean, I, you know, I always say to Greg Fillinghans, you know, the great keyboard player from Quincy, he was our keyboard player. And I call him up down and I go, man, we need to put a band together again. He goes, a band together. He goes, we have a band. We just don't work all the time.
Yeah, yeah, right on.
Well, he's got a point. Yeah, it's probably rock with R&B roots, you know. I've got some great players I play with, like Dave DeLome and Tarek Akoni on guitar. Just a great guitar player. And, you know, we're working on some things right now.
Very cool, man. If you want to reach out to JR and you think and you're interested in work with him either as a producer or you're interested in hiring him to do drum tracks for you, go to his website. It's johnjrrobinson.com and he's got a contact form there. Just be respectful and let him know like what your interest is and what kind of, you know, give him enough information that he could form a logical answer to figure out what's going on. And if it's a fit, you know, I'm sure you guys will connect, but go to johnjrrobinson.com.
Beautiful. Great.
Did I forget anything? Is there anything else you'd like to promote? Please.
I could give you a fingerprint here. Hold on a second. I mean, I you know, I've got a whole bunch of stuff to promote, but I don't really, you know, I'm working on something now that I can't talk about, and it's very technologically sound.
Awesome.
So, you know, I think a lot of us are thinking the way I'm actually putting that out there, but this could be really cool. My drum company DW has got some really cool things coming out, and of course Paiste Cymbals I want to thank, and you know, Remo and Innovative Percussion and Zoom Cameras and Avid and God, there's, you know, I have a list of everybody's been really, really very, very supportive, especially during these, you know, dark times. The David Foster thing, we are scheduled and rebooked October for about 2 weeks, and then we do about a 35-day run in January, February.
Of 2021.
Yep. So,
that's awesome, man.
So hopefully this curve will go away and we can get this live thing, you know, back in the saddle, because I think everybody, and, you know, you're going to see a huge difference of people after this.
I hope so, man. I hope people think a little more and be a little nicer and not let stupid shit and judgments just take over their lives, man, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And it'll happen. I think this will be, you know, I just, I don't understand why Bill Gates wants to shoot me up with a fucking chip. So, I think we need to shoot him up with a chip.
Hey, man, when your record comes out, please come on the show. We'd love to turn people on to it. All right.
I will. And if I only release a single, I'll still come back on.
Right on, man. Hey, listen, thank you very much for everything. Hold on. Let me wrap up. And thanks so much, JR. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks very much to John J.R. Robinson. Again, if you want to connect with him, go to his website, johnjrrobinson.com. And if you're looking for tracks or, you know, talk to him about production, just, you know, give him a heads up and, give, you know, be respectful of his time, obviously. Most important, remember that, especially nowadays, remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice. Go play your guitar or your drums and have fun. Till next time, great. Peace and love, everybody. I'm out. Thank you, brother.
Thanks, bro. Love you, man. See ya.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.